Luong Ong was last here in 2001 when her memoir, First They Killed My Father, A Daughter of Cambodia Remembers, was published. It told the incredible story of her experiences in Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge regime. And she joins me now to talk about her new book, Lucky Child, A Daughter of Cambodia Reunites with the Sister She Left Behind. HarperCollins released it last week to coincide with the 30th anniversary on April 17th of Pol Pot's takeover of Phnom Penh. When she is not writing, Ms. Ong works as an activist against landmines, and she is the national spokesperson for the Campaign for a Landmine-Free World. I'm very pleased that all of that has brought her back to my show today. Hello.
Hello.
Does this book pick up where your last one left off?
Yes, it does. It picks up and follows my life in America, and in parallel that, also my sister's life in Cambodia.
Now, you wound up as after many travels in Vermont, rural Vermont, but she just stayed in Cambodia? Could she have gotten out?
No, our dream in the first couple of years was to come to America, settle down, and then sponsor her out. What we didn't realize then was that America and Cambodia didn't have diplomatic relationships until 1992, and so we weren't able to sponsor her out, and she never got to leave.
One of the big shockers is that the United States actually supported Pol Pot's representative in the UN, despite knowledge of the killing fields.
Yes.
It was just a political thing?
It was. And in 1979, the Vietnamese invaded Cambodia and defeated the Khmer Rouge and halted the genocide. And then they installed a new Cambodian government. The U.S. was incensed over this. And it was with the philosophy and the theory that the enemy of our enemy is our friend. And with the Vietnamese in Cambodia, they continued to support the Khmer Rouge seat in power in the U.N. until 1991.
My guest is Luong Ong, and her book is Lucky Child, A Daughter of Cambodia Reunites with the Sister She Left Behind. It's published by HarperCollins. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. So where was Cho all that time? Was she in Phnom Penh?
No, while I was growing up and trying to survive America and trying to learn to get my hair done right like Farrah Fawcett and adapt to the cold and the snow, my sister, too, stayed behind in our family's village, living a life that was very difficult, trying to grow food on a land filled with mines, in a village where there was no electricity, no running water, living the life that I would have lived if I hadn't left. She eventually ended up being arranged in a marriage at age 18 and giving birth to five children in the village where they're, and never having seen doctors. And when I told her about ultrasound, she thought it was science fiction. You could possibly know the sex of a child before it comes out.
Well, she must have been amazed by all the stories you told her. Since you had been very close when you were younger, I'd imagine that all those years, would have been very difficult to get back to that kind of feeling, considering the fact that your experiences had been so different.
Yes, it was difficult. I didn't return to Cambodia until 1995, and it was after 15 years of escape from it. When I went to Cambodia on that first trip, I was so excited, and that excitement turned to guilt and fear, and then back to excitement. And when I was on the plane and at the airport, landing into Phnom Penh in Cambodia, I entertained all these visions and fantasies of getting off the plane, seeing my sisters, running to her arms, and then there would be this instant connection and love and warmth. And instead, as I came out of the airport, my family members, my sister, were all looking at me with frowns on their faces. And the first word was from my cousin who said to me, "You look like a Khmer Rouge." And it didn't dawn on me until that moment that for 15 years I had succeeded somewhat to put it behind me. But in my clothes, and I was traveling solo by myself in Asia for 6 weeks, and I had a dark shirt, loose-fitting shirt on, a black loose-fitting pants, and Teva sandals, and red bandanas, it reminded them of the uniform the Khmer Rouge used to wear.
So they saw you as being insensitive, and you were just traveling like an American.
Yeah. Well, you know, they just, I don't know if they thought it was insensitive, but it was constantly on their mind. And it took many trips for me to build a relationship with my sister, to form new bonds that was above and beyond our history of the Khmer Rouge.
Now, just fill us in again. How many people were in your family when the Khmer Rouge took over 30 years ago, and how many survive?
Yeah. As a child, I grew up in a big family with my father and mother, three sisters and three brothers, and there were nine of us, and many other relatives and cousins. In the span of the Khmer regime from 1975 to 1979, an estimate of 2 million Cambodians were killed or died to out of the population of 7 million people. Among the victims were both my parents, two sisters, and 20 other relatives.
But your brothers survived, and you escaped with one of your brothers.
After the war, the country was in complete shambles, and we were still living in fear in addition to landmines. We were afraid that the Khmer's would come back into power and then finish its job of just killing all of us. We knew we wanted to find a way out of Cambodia to search for a better life, and there were only two ways out of Cambodia at that time. You had to walk the land, which meant we would have to cross the minefields of Cambodia and Thailand and to end at the refugee camps. Or you go the boat people route, which meant we had to raise money to buy seats that on boats that would take us from Cambodia to Vietnam and into Thailand. We decided to take the less dangerous route, the boat route. But we were only able to raise enough money to take three. It was decided my oldest brother, who is 22, and my sister-in-law, and he had to choose one of the four siblings to take with him. And I made the cut.
Which you say made you feel very guilty for a long time. You wound up in Vermont, of all places. Why not a place that might have been closer in climate to where you came from?
It's when we were at the refugee camp, we didn't know where we would end up. We just knew we wanted to come to America. You're given a piece of paper, and you're supposed to check off the countries you want to go to. We checked off Australia because it was closer to home, and we checked off America. We ended up being sponsored to leave and to a place called Vermont. We didn't know anything about it. And I remember being at the camp and the refugee workers who tried to share with us what America was going to be like. And they would do this by showing movies. And the movies that we saw had plot lines that took place in L.A. or San Francisco or New York. And I was told that Vermont was going to be like that because it's America after all. And it was not. It was a complete surprise to see all the mountains and trees and no tall buildings.
And a lot of snow.
And a lot of snow.
Even cold in the summertime in northern Vermont.
We arrived in Vermont on June 10th of 1980. And when we got off the plane, we were told that it was the summer in June. We were freezing. We were absolutely freezing, and we were told that it was going to get colder. There are no words in the English language to describe the kind of coldness that we had to experience in Vermont during the winter.
Were you the only Asians in the school?
Yeah, basically. I think there might have been another Asian child who was maybe from Vietnamese or was adopted, but I felt very alone, and there was, I had a friend who was from adopted child from South Korea, but she was older than I, and I felt like I was the only Asian child there.
One of your brothers left afterward, but Chu did not. Because of her temperament or because she was married off so young?
She was married off at such a young age, and my brother Kim was able to escape Cambodia in 1995 and cross the minefields and ended up in a refugee camp at a time when they were starting to close the camp, and so it was very dangerous for him. My sister, at such a young age with a husband, and she found herself pregnant right away, just couldn't make that journey, could not risk her life walking the minefields.
You talk about trying to get rid of the guilt, but also the anger. It must have been easier in Vermont than it was for your sister back home, where everywhere she turned was a reminder of all the terrible experiences you'd had.
Yeah. It was, we're very different people in temperament. She's very kind and nurturing and patient, where I was I was a bit wild and troublesome, and You know, this book, I really, you know, for me, is a book about surviving peace. I was in Vermont trying to survive the peace and the war that was still raging on in my mind at night and in my dreams and my nightmares. For my sister, it was literally still a very physical experience of surviving the war, and a time when supposedly the war was over. She was supposed to have been living during a time of peace, and yet everywhere she turned, there were still dangers with landmines. And when she go to sleep, she had to be a very light sleeper because the Khmer Rouge didn't disband, didn't surrender, and lose power until 1998, which meant that they were still living in the jungle and coming out of their hidings to steal cows and bicycles and kidnap boys to force into the armies. So it's still a very dangerous place.
You mentioned the landmines, and we'll talk more about them later. Nearly 1,000 people die every year from landmines. Many more have body parts blown off. So in an odd way, the killing fields continue in Cambodia.
That's absolutely true. And that, you know, on my first trip, and I came to that realization, and that's why I've devoted so much time and energy to helping the survivors of war have a chance to survive the peace. 5 million Cambodians survived the Khmer Rouge genocide. And they survive because they have loved ones, fathers and mothers who sacrificed their lives, sacrificed themselves. They fought and cheated and stole and did everything they could so that they could live. Years after the war, they're still having a hard time surviving it. And in Cambodia, we estimated that we have anywhere between 40-plus amputees who are due to landmines. One out of every 252 Cambodian is an amputee. In America, that number is one out of every 22,000. 25 years after the war, an average of 50 to 100 people every month is still being maimed, killed, and injured by landmines in Cambodia. It is a weapon of mass destruction, albeit it is in slow motion, taking one limb, one life, one leg at a time.
My guest is Luong Ong. Her latest book, a memoir called Lucky Child, The Daughter of Cambodia, reunites with the sister she left behind. It's from HarperCollins. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Luong Ong, who is, among other things, national spokesperson for the Campaign for a Landmine-Free World, a program of the Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation. She lectures extensively throughout the United States about that. But she's also the author now of two volumes of memoir. The most recent, Lucky Child, A Daughter of Cambodia, reunites with the sister she left behind. It's from HarperCollins. You say that survivors of the Khmer Rouge killing fields don't often talk about their experience. You could because you left the country, even though you left after the Khmer Rouge were toppled from power?
You know, I there's that, and I could because I've been very lucky to have met wonderful people who listened and who asked questions. For many years, I wasn't able to talk about it, and people thought I was a shy child, and they sort of walked around it, and I just didn't know the language, I didn't know the words, and I couldn't deal with a heartbreak.
Well, how long before you developed enough facility with English to even try to attempt to talk about it?
And I started writing about it in high school. I remember for the very first time when I did an essay on Cambodia for an English class, and my teacher returned the paper to me with an A++ grade on it, and I was very surprised. I went up to him, and he said I wasn't going to get another A++ until I fixed my grammar. But he just wanted me to know that sometimes contents count more than words, and that he heard what I had to say. That was my first, I believe, just desire to want to speak, to want to tell my story. And I developed not just the language skill to speak on it, but the courage to speak on it when I became an activist. It still breaks my heart. I've talked a lot about it, and each time Many times I'll be on stage and I'll cry and I'll have an emotional experience, but I realize that it's not in vain, that I am using my story to talk about bigger issues, to make sure that the survivors in Cambodia are given help that they need to survive the peace.
It took you a while, didn't it? The first memoir, First They Killed My Father, began from things that you wrote when you were a teenager, and I guess it took years of thinking through the whole story before you could actually write it as a complete memoir.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No. When I was going through puberty as a young child in Vermont, I remember sitting in school and people were teaching us that when you go through puberty as a girl, your body will change and you'll grow certain body parts that were not there before. But they didn't tell you, and they didn't tell me back then, that your mind was also going to change, that the chemical in your brain was going to do a number on you. And I found myself very depressed, going through a severe depression, with dreams and nightmares and the war coming back to me in ways that I couldn't control it. And I would wake up, and every month I would see blood flowing out of my body. And I didn't know if I wanted to live, because the only time I've seen that much blood coming in my body was either people were dying on the streets or they were dead, and I was afraid that I was going to do both.
You were also a child soldier. We've done a number of segments on this show about the continuing problem of the capturing of children and forcing them to fight in wars. You were just 8 years old when you became a child soldier. Did you have any idea of what you were even doing?
No, I didn't. I was eight. Both my parents were killed. I was hungry. My sister died from starvation. I was full of hate and full of rage. And when I used that, when I hurt other people, when I was aggressive, they didn't pull me aside and said, that's not a good thing. They pulled me aside and rewarded me with food. And that worked. For me, that was, I wanted to live. And so I did what they said.
We said earlier that people had a hard time talking about what they had experienced. When you reunited with your sister Chu, was it difficult for you to get her to talk?
Yeah, it was. I have an easier time talking to the bartenders and talking to students, talking to people who hadn't been in Cambodia. But it absolutely broke my heart to talk to my sister about it. When I asked her questions and interviewed her, to see tears flowing from her face, to see her eyes and her soul being taken back to a place that was painful for both of us, there were no barriers and there were no defense mechanism. When I talked to my grandmother, it was the same thing. To see tears and then to watch her hands and place above my grandmother. My grandmother would take her hand and put it above her chest and rubbed it into a circular motion as if to massage her heart, to make it beat, to make it stop, to make it go in pain. When I talked to my brother, I saw his eyes and they were cold. And when I asked him one question about my sister who died at age 4, he said she was just so young, she was so little. And I saw his lips, the bottom lips, quivered. And then he quickly changed smoke and started smoking. Those were the most difficult situations and difficult times for me to be in.
Because they had hardened themselves to the experiences to get through, and you were opening up wounds again.
It was that, and I was opening up wounds for myself as well. When I talked to Americans about it, I could almost have a wall. I could almost be an educator. I could talk about it and be passionate and angry about the injustices of landmines and human rights and the genocide. But when I talked about my family and my sister, there's no such wall to protect me. It was all about love and family and our loss and how much we miss those who aren't here with us.
You also had writing as a way of dealing with your pain. You could figure things out as you wrote them. This was not available to the people who were left behind.
No.
What did they tell you their life had been like?
Their lives were so busy. Their lives were busy with trying to survive every day, trying to find food, trying to escape the wars, trying to raise 5 children on a land where the soldiers are coming in, and you don't know how you're going to feed your children the next day. And you don't know if it's going to be the drought this year, how you're going to shelter them. So it was really touch and go for a lot of parts. They didn't know if they were going to make it.
And you said that your sister didn't believe that there was such a thing as a sonogram. It just seemed too far out. What about some of the other things you told her about your life here? Was she able to grasp any of it?
You know, some of the more universal stuff she understood. How I had a friend who was very much like her in temperament, and how her best friend was very much like me in temperament, and we were almost in a way trying to replace each other. We were the best of friends and playmates as before the war, and then confidants and kindred spirits during the war. And the things that she couldn't really understand were things like snow. And I tell her how cold it would get, and how snow wasn't just a dusting of white stuff on the ground, but feet and more feet of ice on the ground, and how it wasn't snow. There were ice storms and hails, words that I couldn't describe to her in Khmer because there isn't a word. And I would try to tell her, if you have a big refrigerator and you go in there and stay there for 6 months, that's winter. But there weren't any refrigerators. She doesn't have electricity, so she couldn't imagine that.
Would she like to come here, even for just a short visit?
She's very curious now, and it is her dream and my dream that she gets to see what life is like for me and to visit a place that I call home. I've been back over 25 times, and I consider Cambodia a part of my heart and always in my soul. And America is my home at the moment. And
but you've lived here longer than you lived in Cambodia.
I've lived here, many more years. I lived in Cambodia for 10 years and in America for 25 years. And yet, Cambodia was my first love for everything, for the orange color of the monk's robe, the red of the dust, the music, the food, the temperature, the heat, the family, and also somewhere in Cambodia, my parents' spirits and bones and on the land that I continue to love and dream of.
Since family does play such a strong role in the whole Cambodian culture, how have survivors dealt with having family members scattered all over the world, at least the ones who are surviving? How have they dealt with the fact that so many people in their families are no longer with them?
Yeah. They're doing the best they can. The Khmer Rouge, of the 2 million people who killed, if you go back into the Cambodia, you know, the country, you see that there are missing generations. There are generations of grandparents, many of the who didn't make the war because they were, you know, it was hard. There were generations of missing toddlers, people like my little sister who was just 3 years old when the war started, who weren't strong enough to survive. There were generations of babies very few were born and alive during the 4 years when there was no education, there was no food, there was no health system, and you know, I think 60% of Cambodians are today 25 and under, and they just do the best they can to be together.
Well, Pol Pot and his supporters killed anyone who wore eyeglasses because they thought that that meant that they were intellectuals. They killed artists, teachers, anyone who had any serious education. So how does a culture rebound from that kind of a loss?
First, by going back and forming bonds and really just investing in the family again. And secondly, by investing in a new generation of leaders. That is so important. My sister, who wasn't able to go to school, and her education was halted from age 7 on, are now sending her girls and sons to school. In the village, there are no high schools. She had to let them leave her nest, even though she was afraid, and part of her always afraid that the war might come back, and with her kids in the city and she's in a village, they might be separated. But she wants them to be educated. And also just, I think, international communities and people like myself going back and investing, not in just the country, the economy, and doing what we can as citizens of Cambodia, finding ways to be of service, but to pass on skills and the Cambodians there to pass on their compassion and love.
Is that made more difficult by the fact that this is not the ideal government? The current government still has certain totalitarian inclinations.
Cambodia is believe it is a fledgling democracy, but if the government is very corrupt still, and there are issues with poverty and health care and AIDS and many other problems that they're struggling with as a country.
Many of the leaders are former Khmer Rouge themselves.
Yes. With that said, the survivors waited for 26 years for justice, have been patient and strong, and have been working very hard. I mean, we've went from 5 million people to approximately 12 million people population, and majority of them band together to work on the land, to invest in their culture and investing in their children.
There's a Cambodian dance school performing at the Joyce Theater this week, but it's all traditional dances. So some people have still held on to those traditions?
And it's so important to do that. I have a friend, Arnchurn Pon, who started a program called Master in Musicians, where he goes back to Cambodia to look for the master musicians all of the country and then have them train the next generations of Cambodian the art of royal court dancing and music. And also, in addition to that, he has been able to work with Cambodian American kids in Boston, where they're doing rap in Cambodian language. It's just quite a challenge with a message, and it is so important that we hold on to our tradition as well as having our foot in the future and in many different cultures to just grow.
Are you happy with the Bush administration's policies on landmines?
I'm not. Since 9/11, of the many programs that have seen their aid, their fundings cut, programs that have seen, I think, a large cut has been international humanitarian agencies and programs like ours, the Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation, where we have centers in Cambodia and many parts of the world that manufacture prosthetic limbs, wheelchairs, mobility devices to help victims of landmines and victims of war. And we're seeing our fundings cut drastically. And the Bush administration's policy on landmines is, there's no policy on landmines. There's not a lot. So it's just not even on their radar screen and not a focus.
Well, we changed our policy in February 2004, didn't we? A landmine-free world is no longer a goal of the United States, perhaps because of its own decisions to sometimes use landmines.
Yeah. And I am not aware of the policy that was changed in 2007.
2004. We're waiting. 2007 is coming, and maybe we'll have a change then.
Well, there was a policy. It was a Clinton administration policy in 2006, but I am not aware of that one.
My guest, Luong Ung, will be speaking tonight at the Asia Society. That's at 71st Street and Park Avenue at 6:30. Her book, Lucky Child, A Daughter of Cambodia Reunites with the Sister She Left Behind. It is from HarperCollins. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.